What's up, everybody? It's John. Thank you so much for joining me on the Rock Tape Podcast. Today, what I have for you is an interview that I did with David Boland at the 2020 Rock Tape Instructor Summit this past weekend in Mexico. David and I had a really good conversation once we got past all the fun and away from all the seminars that we did as a Rock Tape group. And David is a really interesting guy because he's an orthopedic surgeon that has actually elected to move out of the hospital setting and into more manual therapy. So you're going to get to hear his story and see why he chose that route and how he got into working with Rock Tape. So without any further ado, let's hit the music and let's get going. To sit here with one of our more unique instructors, I feel, David Boland from Berlin, Germany, I believe. Berlin, right?
That is true.
And you are one of the more unique instructors because you're actually an orthopedic surgeon. And what's interesting is every class that I teach, I ask, who's in the room? Who do we have? And I'm always kind of hoping and praying when I say MD, someone's going to raise their hand. But for those of you who don't know, you know, at least internationally, we do have a large scope within our practitioners and our instructors. And you, David, you are an MD and an orthopedic surgeon, so there's gonna be a lot of questions coming out of that and, you know, how you kind of use Rock Tape. But welcome and thank you for taking the time.
Well, thanks, John, for having me. I'm really excited to do this. This is something that's kind of new to me. This is, I think, the second or third podcast I've done. So let's see how that goes. But yeah, I'm excited to be here.
As long as you're not scared to talk about yourself.
People that know me know that talking is something that I'm barely scared of doing. If it's about myself, we can drift off a little, so that's going to take a long.
Well, that's always good, too. We are sitting here in Cancun, Mexico. We just wrapped up today with our annual Instructor Summit, the 2020 Rock Tape Instructor Summit, and this is a great time because this is when I get to see all the international folk. This is the North American summit, but you are obviously from Europe. You guys had your summit a little bit earlier in Prague. So what's it like to kind of do this a couple times around with at least different groups?
Well, it is very different from the one we had in Prague 4 weeks ago, which wasn't Prague, but Budapest. Thank you very much.
Oh, the I was going to say.
Obviously, Cancun beats most places in Eastern Europe this time of year.
In December.
Because of the weather, the beach, and the sun. Mm-hmm. So it was a very different summit than the one we had in Budapest, partially due to the very unique family of instructors that's most of you guys have known each other for years.
Yeah.
And that's something that you really feel when you get into that room. Mm-hmm. Also, due to the fact that we had Dr. Eric Cobb from Z-Health talk to us for a little while, that's something that I find to be very special. In Europe, I'm familiar with the German instructors. Mm-hmm. On the summits, we also meet the ones that are from Czechoslovakia. We meet the Spanish guys, the Russians. We have Scandinavia, the UK. So it's a unique experience in that matter that we really get to hang out and spend some time, see what they do in their marketplace.
Forgive my ignorance for this question, but it just came to mind. You mentioned so many different countries, and the first thing that comes to mind is so many different languages within the European market and Rock Tape in Europe. So again, forgive the ignorance of the question, but is it just that all of you are also fluent in English and you do your summit in English, or is there some sort of translation that goes? It's just a curiosity of mine.
No, the summit is in English. Mm-hmm. Most everybody is pretty fluent in English.
Okay.
There's a few exceptions. There's a few countries that bring their own translator, or one of the guys that is fluent will translate for the rest of the group. But
right.
This time it was completely held in English.
Okay, interesting. Weird questions like that always come to mind.
Well, yeah.
Little logistic stuff. So we first met last year at the Instructor Summit. When did you first come on? Was it last year?
It's last year.
How did you kind of discover Rock Tape? And this is obviously going to be a little bit different than a lot of the American instructors. There's maybe a little bit different process, but how did you come across Rock Tape for the first time?
Well, going back a little bit, I have a history in American football, played 15 years in Germany, and athletic tape obviously was a big part of that. when I went through med school, when I started working in the hospital field, I came across tape, and that being athletic tape, every once in a while. And much like everybody else in the early 2000s or mid 2000s, when we started seeing that colorful tape on athletes, I was intrigued. So I took my tape, my first tape course. Wasn't impressed. Too much origin insertion around the corners. Keep the energy in blue and red. And there's this application for every shoulder injury that you could come across. And about 20 minutes into that course, I knew I'm in the wrong room.
Wow.
But I still thought there must be something to it. So I did another one and a third one. During that time, I started doing CrossFit.
Okay.
And that's in 2012. 2014, I got to visit the CrossFit Games in Carson.
Cool.
There obviously was a huge Rock Tape booth back then, where I guess a bunch of guys that are still here with us taught or actually worked. And after that, I came back home and I was like, okay, I'm finding a Rock Tape course. It took a good while to find one in Germany. Mm-hmm. During that time, while I was still looking around, I tried using kinesiology tape of different brands and found that there were things that, well, didn't really, I couldn't make up my mind about it. Mm-hmm. So would it work? Did it not work? Did it stay on? Did it not stay on? So when I finally got to a Rock Tape course, 20 minutes in, I knew I found people that are thinking the way that I do, not treating symptoms, being way more, way broader in their approach. And leaving that course, I knew I wanted to stay on board, and I got on the phone with Olli Derricks, who used to lead Rock Tape Germany back then, and told him that I was excited and I'd like to see if we could get something done. Mm-hmm. So I started working events, and at the CrossFit Games Regionals in Berlin in 2018, we had a long conversation. I worked athlete services alongside a bunch of physiotherapists and chiros. And just took care of athletes using Rock Tape tools, Rock Tape, and after that I knew I wanted to become an instructor. So he walked me through the process. I shadowed him a lot, shadowed other instructors, and started teaching last year.
Do you think it was more the education process? You mentioned, you know, a lot more like-minded individuals within those courses. Was it the product itself, you know, better quality? Because I know a lot of people get disenchanted with some of the lower quality tapes, and some people dismiss tape altogether when it doesn't stay on.
It's a combination. Of course, the quality of the tape is much better than what I've seen with other brands. I've had patients that I taped that told me the next time they came into my office that it didn't stay on very long. I had people that went out my office, got on their bike, rode home, and the tape just fell off. So that obviously was, maybe I just wasn't made for tape. That is something that I didn't think.
Sure.
Maybe it's the quality. So, but what really resonated with me was the education, the approach to tape, the approach along fascial lines, the approach of looking in different planes, breaking down movements, seeing where restrictions could be and how we could help with that. Mm-hmm. So that's pretty much the reason why we're here today.
Absolutely. And you, again, you know, such a unique perspective being an orthopedic surgeon. So, you know, as you tell us about your story, you know, tell us a little bit about your training. And you had told me earlier this weekend, too, kind of your evolution of practice. And I'm very interested for you to tell the audience about how you practice, because I think most people that hear orthopedic surgeon, they're going to make assumptions about that, too. So tell us a little bit about your training, kind of where that passion for healthcare came from outside of your football career, and then, you know, how it evolved to what you're doing today.
I think my story is not so different from your other instructors, because being an athlete, playing football, I got hurt.
Yeah,
I tore an ACL, I had my knee scoped, I dislocated my shoulder, things just happened, and I was always interested in the rehab process. And rehab process to me was more than doing 3 sets of 10 or something and hoping that it would heal. Mm-hmm. I wanted to know how things worked. So when I had the opportunity to go to med school, I did, and from day one in med school, I knew I wanted to be an ortho surgeon. I wanted to fix athletes. I wanted to, fix ACLs and torn labrums,
sure.
Make sure that people could run, walk, and play sports again. During that time in Germany, the field kind of changed. So they put together in one discipline, ortho and trauma.
Okay.
So right out of med school, I started a residency in a hospital that was a level one trauma center. So I was working on car accidents and high-level trauma before I knew what to do with a sore neck.
Wow.
So I did that for a while, and after about 3 years, I found that that's really not something that my limbic system could handle for a long time. So that's not what I wanted to do, so I progressed into a different hospital, focused on total knees, total hips, geriatric trauma, smaller trauma, a lot of fractures, and stayed there, really received my entire training, became a consultant there, stayed for a long time, and really got frustrated in the hospital world because you see patients come in, they get their surgeries, and you see them leave. Mm. You never know how the buildup to that point was, and you won't see how things work out for them. So that was something that was frustrating for me. So during that time, I started taking classes in manual therapy, in acupuncture, in FDM, in kinesiology taping, and kind of tried to broaden my spectrum a bit because I knew I was going to step out of the hospital realm eventually, which yeah. I did in 2015. So I've been working in a clinic ever since then. And that's pretty much when I started to reduce my surgical time. So in the German system, if you work in a clinic, you can refer patients into hospitals or you can perform certain surgeries yourself. Obviously, trauma is something that fell off the ladder entirely. I still did total knee, total hip for a while. I did foot surgery, small scopes, things of that matter. But it became clear to me pretty quickly that if the numbers of my surgeries go down, at some stage, I will not be able to provide the quality that I want. Mm. So I looked into different fields, started gaining an interest in shockwave therapy. That's something that I really like. And combining different therapy forms. Mm-hmm. And over the course of time, I changed or switched clinics and really decided I want to go out on my own, do my own thing, in terms of being non-traditional insurance, a non-traditional insurance ortho, mm-hmm. but doing something more along the lines of cash-based and really focusing on the patient and to invest some time into that patient.
It's such a unique perspective, at least in the United States, from most MDs and especially orthopedic surgeons. And I don't mean this to sound disparaging to any professional. It's just there's a traditional sense that orthopedic surgeons are doing surgery. I've never heard of any orthopedic surgeon realizing exactly what you did, and that, you know, they don't get to spend a lot of time in between, or I should say after that surgery, and really kind of help that patient along that journey post-surgically, except for follow-ups and things like that too. Was this, not that you have to answer to anybody, but was this a popular decision? Did you have any pushback from anybody else in your field?
It wasn't one day I woke up and decided I wanted to be a conservative ortho surgeon.
Sure.
It's something that grew gradually as I progressed in my teachings and finding different modalities to use, and really from gaining a lot of appreciation for movement and really using the body what it's originally made for, instead of trying to fix parts and exchange parts. Mm-hmm. We're not talking about a car that needs a new carburetor. We're talking about people and cartilage, and we talk about mechanics, biomechanics, neurology, and that's something that just does take time, and over the course of probably years, I kind of could see myself removing myself a little bit from the traditional surgical field.
So talked a lot about tape. Tell us a little bit about your current practice, you know, things that you're doing. You use tape, a lot of the other rock tape tools. Are you using instruments, pods, floss, things like that as well too?
Yes. It's always hard for me to explain what I do when I see patients because every visit is really designed for the individual.
Right.
So that's one of the reasons why it takes time. So we mm-hmm. sit down, we talk a little bit, then there's going to be a screening assessment eval, and the things I do, I combine using diagnostics, ultrasound, mm-hmm. combine it with therapeutic. Partially, I still do a little bit of manual therapy. I use my shockwave. I use cryotherapy. I follow that up with tape. I use floss and pods quite frequently. To be honest, the blades I don't use that often because that is something I think belongs more in the therapeutic world into somebody who really regularly treats their patients.
Okay.
I don't want to steal any physio's work. I don't want to steal any patient from Kairos.
Okay.
So it's, to me, it's part of really digging into the problem that my patient has and trying to help out, find out a solution, help to get beyond that and really get on that journey to get them better.
Yeah. I mean, whatever it takes, right? Yeah.
True.
And that is something that we can definitely appreciate, you know, something we've been talking about all weekend here at the summit is the individual patient and you know, N of one. So very important topic there. You mentioned a couple times the shockwave therapy. I'm very interested in hearing about that. I'm honestly not very familiar with it outside of just hearing it about it a couple times, but I couldn't tell you anything about it. So tell us a little about shockwave and what it is.
Well, shockwave essentially is, oh my God, I'm going to get into trouble here for starting to talk about physics. Let's keep that superficial.
We nerd out on this podcast.
So shockwave is, there's two kinds. There's the ballistic, which essentially is a steel ball in an aluminum rod that's propelled with air pressure onto a little transducer.
Okay.
So that is going to be a little clicking, hitting. It's not a percussion instrument because the percussion instruments that you know, the vibrating tools,
yeah.
They stay fairly superficial. Shockwave has a very different different way of penetrating the skin, the soft tissue. You can even affect bones with it.
Okay.
As I said, the ballistic already sounds aggressive. It's already something where you know a certain level of pain is going to be involved.
Good point.
I'm not trying to cause you pain, but if that's something that we need to get you better, I will apply it in a way that you can handle it. So the other type is the, how did I pronounce that correctly? The piezoelectric?
Piezoelectric.
Piezoelectric, okay. Thank you. Which is one that is much more subtle. I can also crank up the intensity and you will feel that, especially if we're treating inflamed or injured tissues. And that really goes from your plantar fasciitis, mm-hmm. to the tennis elbow, to the unspecified low back pain. But what's beautiful is the way it works is not, we're again not breaking up scar tissue, we're not breaking up calcifications, but we're increasing the tissue metabolism, so to speak.
Okay.
So I'm helping the body to progress faster in the process of healing.
Okay.
So that's something that I like to do, and that works great. It works on acute and chronic.
Yeah.
In the US, I know you guys do a lot more with laser.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. So that is something you could compare these two modalities.
Okay.
Not in the way they work, but for what they're used.
Can you explain a little bit more about the mechanism of how it works? You know, like, for instance, our blades, we talk about receptors and things like that. Is there anything to that nature that could make sense of it?
It is. We're modulating the way that the body releases mediators. Pain,
okay.
Mediators, growth factors. Of course, when I talk about tissue metabolism, there's the nutrition and the neoangiogenesis, forming of new blood vessels.
Sounds good to me.
Okay. Listen, I talked to Mitch Hauschild earlier. How hard it is. I know these words in Latin. I know how to pronounce them in German.
Right.
Now pronouncing them in English is a task. Well, remember, second language.
Right. Well, angiogenesis. You just emphasize a different,
yeah,
syllable. Basically, it's all the same, right?
Yeah. So that's. If you take your classic tennis elbow,
mm-hmm.
A proven way of treating that is a single cortisone shot, which will relieve the pain instantly and probably for about a week or 10 days.
Mm-hmm.
What happens after that? After that cortisone shot becomes obsolete because,
yeah,
of, well, the body pretty much dissolve that that shot. Mm-hmm. With shockwave, we get a later onset. So the first treatment is going to be a little painful. Mm-hmm. You might possibly feel a swelling, a numbness, like a superficial numbness. We're not talking paralysis here.
Okay.
In the tissue, but you should be able to move freely after. There are studies that showed that after, if you compare a cortisone shot and shockwave therapy over the course of 4 weeks, after 2 weeks, cortisone will not do anything anymore. The shockwave, or the effects of the shockwave, will still be measurable. So we get a faster, longer effect that essentially has, we're leaving the body intact.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting too. So you're talking about a lot about chemical mediators, and what's interesting is what you said about cortisone. It's metabolized in the body.
Yes.
Like, this is shock waves. There's nothing to metabolize. So better effects, longer lasting effects.
Yes.
Very interesting. Does this device make kind of like a strange clicking noise?
When All it? Right. Well, we had a little hiccup there, so let's get back into it. Shockwave therapy, just mentioning, I think I've seen this before. It kind of makes this loud clicking noise. It almost looks like a Theragun hypervolt kind of thing, or at least what I've seen. Is that right, or is it kind of a different looking device to it?
See, this is the fun thing about a podcast. I can show you how it looks, and
but no one else will see it.
We'll have to just go on my website and see how it looks. See what it looks like.
So this is very effective for, as you said, inflammation, but obviously for a lot of chronic injuries,
the plantar fasciitis, basic, stuff like that. Or the classic indications are calcified tendinosis in your rotator cuff, the Achilles tendon pain, or the plantar fasciitis, and also the delayed union of bones.
So oh, wow.
That's something where we can use it. Not on everyone, not on every late, not on every delayed union, but it's something that's definitely worth a try.
Yeah.
Especially because what other options are there?
Okay.
Instead of opening up, and refreshing the fracture site, and screwing it back together.
Good point. Good point. Did you pull up that picture?
Yep.
Let's take a look at it. Yeah, so I was absolutely wrong. It kind of almost looks like an ultrasound cart.
It kind of looks like I'm trying to get a better picture of the transducer that we're using.
Okay.
Which is...
Is this something that's fairly popular over in Europe and in Germany? I mean, it might just be that I don't know, but I don't know of too many people in the United States that are using the shockwave therapy.
I've talked to a few people over here that told me that back in physio school, they saw shockwaves, but mostly the radial one. That's the ballistic one.
Okay.
This is something that I think in the U.S. market is not very popular.
Okay.
Over in Germany, it is something that is used a lot. It's something that it's not reimbursable. So you're going to pay for it yourself.
Right. That's how that stuff gets driven, right? So in practice, you know, you labeled yourself as a conservative orthopedic surgeon.
That's the term that Allison coined.
I like that because to me that says you don't automatically say, well, this is a surgical case, let's do it. It sounds as if you go, okay, well, let's try different therapies. And you always have the surgery as a last-ditch option. In my personal and clinical opinion, I am... not anti anything, but you know, the orthopedic surgeons that I've worked with in the past, you know, are like-minded, and we've always been, surgery should be our last attempt, because we want to try everything before that, and if nothing's getting better, then yeah, maybe we do. And in certain cases, yes, it is a surgical case. So what sort of things do you do when a patient comes to you? What's your process? What are some of your favorite tools other than the shockwave that you mentioned to be using?
Primarily, I look at what do they want initially? Mm. So I set them down and I listen for a little while to what they have to say. How long do they have they had this problem? Is it a trauma? Is it something chronic? Is it overuse? Is it a sports injury? I deal with a lot of athletes, primarily CrossFitters. It seems they always have something going on. And obviously, they can't go under or in for surgery whenever the shoulder hurts. So finding out, is it more of a postural problem that we can solve with corrective exercises, a little bit of therapy, be it just postural training or retraining, motor retraining? Is it something where for a moment we have to think about tissue engineering? So that's something I also do. I recently, or for a while now, I've been doing PRP to enhance, again, the growth factors in tissues.
Remind me what that stands for. I'm forgetting.
Platelet-rich plasma.
Platelet-rich plasma.
What I do is I draw blood from the patient. Mm-hmm. It goes into a centrifuge. So we get a higher concentration of the blood platelets, which I can, under ultrasound direction or directing through ultrasound, I get that to the site where I want it, and can inject it into that to help the body rebuild tissue.
Interesting. That is something that's definitely popular in the United States. I've heard a lot about that as well, too.
So yep.
Very interesting. I never knew the process either about that, and the extraction of the platelets and how it worked. But, you know, people, when you talk about injecting anything,
yep,
and then you talk about blood or platelets for that matter too, people are always a little squeamish, a little cautious. But it's your own.
But then again,
stuff.
This to me is sort of a no-brainer. It's
mm-hmm.
your own blood.
Mm-hmm.
There's nothing added to it, so that makes for very little chance of allergies and. The risk management is a lot easier than with any medication.
Yeah.
You can combine it with other modalities. HA, hyaluronic acid,
mm-hmm.
is one of them. Of course, I have cortisone in my drawer.
Sure.
Because it's a great drug. It works. It works wonders. You just got to know when to use it for whom. So it's really a broad variety of things, and it really depends on the individual that I'm facing.
Mm-hmm. Since you mentioned it, hyaluronic acid, I might not be up to date on it right now, but last I checked, certain injections like HA were only approved for knees, and I think shoulders were on the way. Are you guys using it for more things over in Germany, or do you have kind of that approval process where it's one joint or one area of the body, and then you have to wait on other things?
It's mainly larger joints.
Okay.
Hip, knee, shoulder, I barely do it because that's really not what we need there. We have other ways of dealing with it. But
right.
If you go to the smaller ones, if you go to the thumb, to the foot, and you have really joints that seem to not be moving, to not be able to glide the way they should,
mm-hmm.
that always is an option.
Right, right. So tell me about some of your favorite manual therapy applications or tools that you're using. You mentioned you are trained in fascial distortion model. That's always an interesting, I'm losing the words. That's always an interesting technique to talk about.
Yeah, I think it's a great, great model. I don't know if everybody that listens knows what we're talking about. So FDM, fascial distortion model, created by Stefan Tipaldos.
Mm.
Is an approach that really follows the different fascial lines, also the different types of fascia.
Mm-hmm.
So there's this model talks about how distortion of that fascial tissue is something that can cause pain, be it at the site of the pain or somewhere along that fascial line.
Right.
Which is, from a model standpoint and from a diagnostic standpoint, I think it's a fantastic tool. The techniques in themselves, or a lot of them, are very aggressive and
mm-hmm.
painful. So
right.
that, again, limits to who can I use that on. If you have people that come from a sports world that have been to chiros and sports physios, they know things can hurt.
Yeah.
If you sit on the sideline and it's a matter of going back out, you're probably willing to accept a lot more pain than if you usually sit at a desk in your office and you're not used to pain. So
yeah.
That's something that I do. What would be the tool at hand? Probably my hands.
Yeah.
For certain distortions in the model, floss actually is a great tool.
Okay.
That works very well. And again, it's a matter of loading tissue, seeing what the tolerance is and how we work together to get that out.
Okay. So. Okay. How would you use floss, for instance, you know, without going into great detail about how to, you know, assess through that model, how would you use that floss?
Well, there is a distortion model that, without getting too deep into that model, that really talks about that the cylindrical fascia, what in their model is, for instance, your forearm.
Mm-hmm.
If there is a distortion, it is something that reacts very well to compression and to compression and shearing techniques. So that's your floss. So your basic 50-50 application with a little external or internal glide movement from the outside or moving the joint, the arm, is something that could that patient could benefit from.
Right.
What I like about floss, it's easy to teach your patient a few applications themselves. So everybody that, or most people that come to see me will get some sort of homework, be it exercises, be it self-treatment, because I need a certain amount of buy-in and compliance to really be successful with treating people.
Yeah. I mean, do you get a lot of people that they almost make the assumption, it's a surgical case, you know, you're a surgeon, that's why I came to you, and then do you almost have to kind of really draw them in and explain to them we want to do some manual therapy first? Is that a struggle for you?
The surgical patients, or the patients that come with mostly surgical cases, oftentimes are second opinions.
Okay.
People that have been sent to me for another idea, another way of treating that. I have one of my favorite patients, he's 78 years old now. He was sent to me 4 years ago for a second opinion of a bilateral total knee. Without getting into his case in too much detail, I can say that 4 years later, he's still walking on his own knees. We offloaded him for a while with braces. We combined shockwave and did actually some hyaluronic acid. He's got insults. He's 78, so we tried proprioceptive for a while. Did not really work, so now it's fixed ones that get adjusted every year. And this summer he went hiking with his wife, so
that's great.
I'm pretty happy. And it all always depends. Not everybody needs to go out hiking and skiing. There's people that are perfectly content with their activities of daily living, and that's one of the cases. He just didn't want to get less active than he was.
Yeah, I like that. That speaks very specifically to the individual. You're right. Not everybody needs to be healed for the purposes of doing something they've never done before, too. Yeah. So, you mentioned the proprioceptive insoles. I'm fascinated by these, and you've used them for quite some time. So tell us a little bit about those. These are really cool things.
Well, the idea is that the typical insoles, the ones that you know that kind of help you raise that arch, kind of put a little pressure behind your metatarsals, that is something that will help for a moment. But your body is a little too complex for that approach. I believe that your foot is made up of a few muscles, which connect to muscles above that.
Mm-hmm.
So your foot, your arches of your foot, your ankle, your knee, your hip, your low back, all of that, your pelvis is all connected. And I think it's a little simplified approach to say, I put you on a brace. Nothing else, insoles or nothing else, orthotics, and expect a change up the chain.
Yeah.
So the proprioceptive way is, and there's different models of those, the ones that I typically use, work through little pressure pads that will activate or stimulate. Let's say stimulate instead of activating. We're not turning anything on. Mm-hmm. So they're trying to activate and upregulate certain, be it muscle insertions in your foot to help you train the muscles of your foot while you're walking or even sitting at a desk.
Okay.
So to me, regaining strength in your foot muscles, and I know I will be stepping on some toes, regaining that muscle, that strength just by training is a very strenuous exercise.
Sure.
So you need to be really strict. You need to do a lot of work every day, and it will take a long time to get better.
Yeah.
You have muscles higher up the chain that have much more anabolic potential.
Okay.
That you can use to stabilize yourself.
Yeah.
If my insoles help you activate the way that that chain, a lot of it is posterior chain, works, will help you stand up straighter. I'm not calling out specific muscles that you're activating because I don't want to promise that your glutes are going to be turned on.
Sure.
But what we do is we're activating or we're retraining your body and doing that every day for hours. So that's something that I've seen a lot of success with. I'm not fixing a flat foot into a beautiful arch.
Yeah.
But it's something we're talking about helping people get better.
Yeah.
It's not fairy dust.
Oh, I love that. Yeah. Really cool stuff. A lot of really unique things that you combine. You know, tell people where your practice is located. How can anybody reach you if they're looking to get a hold of you? Maybe ask some questions.
So, like you stated earlier, I'm from Berlin, Germany. Mm-hmm. That's where I'm located. I'm in the dead center of the inner city.
Okay.
Very nice area. I just opened that clinic 3 months ago.
Yeah, congratulations.
Had the whole place refurbished. Have a beautiful little movement and weight room in the back. We haven't talked about that yet because
go for it.
I put in a little rack, a little platform, a little turf. So
you need a place for yourself to work out too.
That's typically what my wife would say. She says that I only put all that in there because I need to work out. I do need to work out, but it's also used to... I do small in-house seminars. I also have patients that typically tell me in their day-to-day they're fine, but when they lift 200 pounds off the floor, they're in pain. So I tell them, get over there, get on your little assault bike, warm up, put 200 pounds on the bar, and show me what your problem is. Let's assess how you move and why you move.
I love that.
The best place to find me is online. So my website is ortho-b.de. It's probably going to be in the show notes.
Yes.
And through Instagram, TheFunkDoc, that's me. These are the two places where you're going to find me.
Yeah.
If I can help out, just hit me up, write me, text me. We'll get to it.
Okay, so one more thing, one last thing rather, that I really kind of want to get into because I get this question a lot. I have a certain answer. I feel like sometimes it becomes a contentious argument. Maybe it's the tone of voice that I use when I answer, but you being an orthopedic surgeon, probably having dealt with this, probably having a better answer. I get a lot of people, they ask questions about our tools, whether it be the blades, the tape, even floss and pods. The most basic question is it safe for a blank replacement? And it's a weird question to me because for a lot of reasons, but the biggest thing is, you know, people will downgrade the effect of tape or tools or, you know, even go to the extent of saying, oh, those don't work, blah, blah, blah. But then when you talk about using it on someone who might have a replacement, they're like, oh my gosh, don't do that. It could ruin it. If it doesn't work, how could it ruin that too? So obviously that's ridiculous. But my response is, you know, going back to some of the more rock tape concepts that we use, you being a surgeon, you having a lot of experience with that kind of hardware, what would you just say to someone when they ask you the question is, you know, is it safe to use X tool over a replacement?
I'm pausing. Take a deep breath.
He's getting ready. He's getting ready.
Well, listen, with all of our tools, we're working, what are we working? We're not working with brute force on joints. We're trying to communicate with tissue, which means superficial, which means skin and fascia,
mm-hmm.
which means that if somebody has a total hip, that's going to be 2-3 inches deep in their body, and you expect me to really influence that by a strip of tape?
Yeah.
Thanks for trusting my tape.
Thanks for thinking the tape is that powerful.
It is powerful, but no. To my mind, there's a... The newer model, newer protocols for rehab, for total knee, total hip, have changed completely over the last 20, 25 years in terms of people are allowed much earlier to gain more range of motion. Studies were able to show that if you have a total hip, the risk of dislocation is not associated with certain movements. When the only thing that happens under movement or range of motion limitation is that the patient is less happy because he's not independent. So if my patient is allowed to essentially move after the first couple of days, couple of weeks, freely, why should he not be able to wear tape?
Yeah.
I believe that with the tape, what we're doing, we're creating awareness of the system of a certain area. Wouldn't you like to get more awareness in a freshly operated or into a replaced hip?
Sure.
One of the problems we have is that if we're dealing with high-grade osteoarthritis, we often have the problem that people have gotten weaker. It's much like low back pain, where the awareness of certain areas, their body maps are just not functioning right.
Right.
So if we use tape, if we use floss or blades to increase that, I think that would be very beneficial.
Mm-hmm.
Especially for tape, I believe that done right, it's a great option post-op, post-surgical, early on. Of course, you do not want to go over a fresh scar. But if we're talking fluid dynamics,
you mean an open wound? You don't want to get an open wound, yeah?
Not an open wound as long as it. Let's be very basic and say as soon as it's dry,
yeah.
I think it's safe to tape around it. And if you want to, if you want to stay an inch away from the edges of the scar, that's fine.
You still have influence over it.
We can. We're trying to tape for old scars. Why not tape new scars so that we don't get the restrictions that we used to deal with on a day-to-day.
Right.
Also, fluid dynamics. Total knee is something that tends to swell up very impressively. So taping for that makes sense. Motor training, again, and that's your floss, that's your pods, that's your tape, is something these patients could benefit from.
Yeah.
If they have a therapist, a clinician that knows what they're doing.
Yeah. And let's be realistic. What are these replacements made with? I believe titanium is the standard right now.
Yes. So
tape versus titanium, what's going to win, right?
I sincerely hope that you're not able to loosen a total knee by applying pods.
That, I think, is a quote that I'm going to remember for a very, very long time. Who's to blame if that's the case, right? It's probably more the surgeon who didn't put it, that wasn't put in correctly, then, if a pod can do that.
Well,
but
people are
very
people.
Unlikely.
People are people. I've seen patients do the craziest things with fresh knees, fresh hips.
Really?
Can
you give us a great example?
Well, one of my favorites is an 82-year-old male who was cutting his toenails in his bathroom sink.
Mm.
So he needed a lot of flexion, a lot of external rotation, and at some stage he actually dislocated his hip.
Wow.
So, yeah. And he was not happy.
The hip was replaced?
It was a replacement.
Like, recently?
You're not going to be able to dislocate your own hip.
Yeah.
And that was I think, something like 2 weeks after. So that was at a very vulnerable point in time. So I think certain limitations to range of motion apply.
That's what I hear most commonly, is that it's range of motions and certain with range of motions positions,
yeah,
that should be.
So
it
depends,
yeah.
on the total hip. It's probably a matter of what approach was used to perform the surgery.
Yeah.
So if you're going through weak tissue that has been compromised, essentially where the approach was, you probably do not want to try to perform splits.
Yeah. So, yes.
Yeah.
Most people don't have the goal of replace my hip so I can get back to doing those splits.
Yes, but as people get bigger meaning fatter, we have more joint wear.
Mm-hmm.
We have younger patients demanding knee and hip replacements, and they have a very different mindset as to what they should be able to do afterwards.
Right, right. Yeah. That mentality of, well, you fix me, I can just go back to normal, right?
And that's what I like to say. This is not a one-stop shop. You're not getting your tires fixed. We're changing something major on your body. This is one of the largest surgeries that you will do without it being vitally important.
Yeah.
Nobody has ever died of osteoarthritis in their hip.
Sure.
So it is, it's a highly elective procedure.
Yeah.
And it is something that when I operate on it, and that takes, I don't know, about an hour, I'm done after that. This is when the patient's work starts.
Right.
And for many people, it takes 3 months, 6 months to get back to where they are hoping to get to.
Yeah. And that's where all these tools come in, all that therapy comes into play.
Where I think a therapist, a mindset, and an alliance of the therapist and the patient are really vital in creating goals that are attainable.
Yeah.
And it actually starts before surgery. We need to tell the patient, you're not getting a new hip.
Yeah.
We're replacing it with a model of a hip. It's a mechanical model. It's not a new hip. So there are limitations to what they can do and what they can hold.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a great point. Thank you so much. That's always a fun question to kind of get into, and got me in trouble one time because of my answer. But not to say that my answer was rude or anything like that. But what was your favorite thing about Mexico this weekend?
Listen, it's the dead of the winter in Berlin, so
that's Chicago, obvious. Yeah?
No, getting out into the sun, I was lucky enough to bring my family along, and we got to stay a couple of days longer, and we went to visit the Maya pyramids in Chichen Itza.
Yeah.
And that was just unbelievable.
Yeah.
So that was amazingly beautiful. It was, I'm not going to say a spiritual experience, but it pretty much was.
Yeah.
So that was really nice.
I saw some pictures at the Fun Doc on Instagram. So check that out definitely. And I brought my family too, and our wives got together and bonded. And our girls, I think, love each other. So
yeah.
That was always fun to watch.
Last night when we had our little team building exercise, our girls were dancing and entertaining the entire room. So that was
dancing nice. Around, and at one point just started rolling around on the floor together.
Yeah, that was nice. That was really, really grateful that I was able to bring them. So,
and I didn't realize I was saying something to your daughter, and your wife came by and said, "Oh, well, she can't understand you. She doesn't speak English." And then I thought about her with my daughter. And I'm like, "That's so beautiful that they're having so much fun, and their communication is all body language, stuff like that."
My son's nine. He's had English in school for a little bit, so he understands actually a whole lot.
Yeah.
But my daughter does not understand a thing. But these two girls playing in the pool, they don't need language. Actually, they do talk. So my daughter will talk her ear off, but the response she gets is a nonverbal one. So it works.
It doesn't. You always speak a common language when it comes to just playing around, I guess.
Yeah.
It's fun to watch. So thank you for taking the time to do this.
It's a pleasure, John. I have listened to your podcast for a long time, and to be on it is really an honor. Thank you.
Well, I appreciate you. Thank you for sharing your knowledge and your expertise, and I'm very happy that we have you on the team.
Glad to be here. It's a great family.
All right, let's get back to having fun.
All right.